हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 28. Sukadeva Goswami continued, Nanda Maharaj, for the sake of the affluence of his own son Krishna, gave the brahmanas cows, fully decorated with garments, flower garlands, and gold necklaces. So here, for the affluence, right? So that, because if you do pious work, then you get facility. Right? So just so his son would have so much nice facility, then he gave so much charity and everything. Right? Because especially then if you give to qualified Brahmins, whatever you give, then the result that comes back is many, many times more than that. Right? Does that make sense? So a qualified Brahmin in that, then generally the standard is, how you say, 10,000 or if they're even more, 100,000. You know, so it's quite good.
In this lifetime?
Generally it's later, but it may be this lifetime. How much time? Oh, like too old, okay. Yeah, forget it. Okay. These cows, fully qualified to give ample milk, were given to the Brahmins in charity, and the Brahmins accepted them and bestowed blessings upon the whole family, and especially upon Krishna. The Brahmanas, who were completely expert in chanting the Vedic hymns, were all yogis, fully equipped with mystic powers, right? So now we're talking about the 100,000 walas. Whatever blessings they spoke were certainly never fruitless. Srila Prabhupada comments, Brahmins fully equipped with the Brahminical qualifications are always yogis, fully powerful in mystic yoga. Their words never fail. In every transaction with other members of society, Brahmins are certainly dependable. In this age, however, one must take into account that the Brahmins are uncertain in their qualifications. Because there are no yagyic Brahmins, all yagyas are forbidden. Because here, yagyic Brahmins doesn't mean someone who does a yagya. Yagyic Brahmins means that they who are initiated into the Shrauta yagyas. So in this case, yagyic Brahmins would be those who can do the Ashwamedha and all those kind of yagyas. Doesn't mean the daily yagyas, that's the yagyic Brahmin. And here, because the daily stuff that goes on, Gopal Bhatta Goswami gave us the details, Prabhupada would do yagyas. But we're talking about these Shrauta yagyas, these big, you know, takes 50, 60, 100 Brahmins to do, you know, everybody has to be perfect, one syllable's off, the whole thing's ruined, so that's what they mean is when it's said there.
Expert in chanting, the
Vedic hymns? Yeah, completely expert in chanting. So not even expert, but completely expert. That means not even one syllable will be ever wrong.
Yes.
Generally, yeah, but they don't necessarily have to be, but I'm saying they could be devotees, they could be, it just depends on the age. This is a previous age, so it would be more standard. This age, probably a little less standard.
And this is Shrauta yagyas as well, or Shrauta Brahmins?
The yagyas are called Shrauta, but they're just yagyic Brahmins, so they do all these fancy stuff, you know. I once went to the house of a yagyic Brahmin in Vrindavan. And, you know, the room where he'd do the yagyas, it was, you know, medium size. I mean, at least according to local standards. In the West, it would have been a big room. And so, then, he had the kund in the middle and all kinds of shelves and that. He had so many different kinds of spoons. Because each different kind of offering or each different kind of thing requires a different spoon. You just don't have one set of spoons that does everything. It's not. Yeah. Or no set of spoons and you know, get anything. You know, someone's serving soup. Excuse me, I'll take that. Yeah. And so then, you know, that's. But they had all these different things, huge things, small ones, different shaped ones, all these different things like this. And you have to know exactly which one goes with which. That's why completely expert. Because you get one thing wrong, it's a problem. So that's one of the most detailed things is then the karmakarma yajnas. You know, all these yajnas, then exactly how all these things are done. They have to be so qualified, these brahmins. So in Kali Yuga, it just doesn't happen. Because there cannot be one syllable wrong in the chanting, or one ritual done, you know, with the wrong mantra, or a wrong spoon, or at the wrong time, or, you know, the wrong, whatever it is. Sometimes there's even according to what are the astrological calculations, like that. So they're very, very, so when we think that, okay, we're doing our yajna and all that. Oh, this is so ritualistic. That's because we don't know what ritualistic is. 90 Brahmins all doing their thing, all these things, not one syllable can be wrong. There's all these technical things. It takes you 1 year to actually accomplish the whole yajna, because it took you 9 months to build the kunda and make the arrangements and collect the dirt from this mountaintop and this side of the river and that side of the river, and from where a boar has dug up the earth, you know, that you have to go to France for. Leave the truffles, just get the dirt, you know, like that, because they've already taken the truffles anyway, so don't worry about it. And then all these different things, it takes you 9 months literally to have it ready. And that's by all qualified technical this and that. And we're upset if the Brahma doesn't show up to do the yajna for us with all the stuff, you know, like that. And if we actually have to go out and spend an hour or something getting this stuff, oh boy, this is that's coming out of his dakshin, that's for sure, right? You know? Yeah. So here's 9 months. So that's why only the kings would have the facility and the people and the influence that they could bring things from all over, you know, in India or extended beyond that to get all the ingredients. That's why they're not a regular thing. Does that make sense? So that qualification of a but it's not that everybody's always doing it, but it doesn't mean the Brahmins aren't qualified to do it. Right? It's not that Yudhishthira Maharaj wants to do the Rajasuya sacrifice, so now the Brahmins have to start preparing, you know, training themselves and this and that. Yeah, give us 3 years and then we'll... No. They're already ready. Even if nobody asks them, they're ready their whole life. Does that make sense? So therefore they can be that of that quality. Even though it's the previous age where that was the method of self-realization. But you see, at this time of Krishna, Yudhishthira Maharaj was doing these big yajnas, right? Because he had already done the Rajasuya, then Duryodhana, he couldn't do it because he can't do it. I think I'm not saying. I think it's within the same lifetime or something. Once it's done, then no one during that lifetime can do it. It has to be, you know, whoever that was involved. They're gone. Then you can do it again. It's something far out like that, or in the same dynasty. There's something. Once it's done, that's it. Otherwise, everybody will be trying to out impress the other, and no one will be able to do it. Because the amount of wealth it takes and everything and time is just like that. Otherwise, people will try to do it, but they won't do it because it's properly. Because these yajnas, if you don't do it fully, better don't do it at all. Just like for a soma yajna, that someone may perform a grihastha, if you don't have foodstuffs, grains collected that will maintain your scene for 3 years, right? You know, puts the Mormons to shame, right? The 3 years, you know, we're not talking about, you know, a nuclear family, we're talking about an Indian family. And Karmakandi means they have sons, right? Yeah. You know, the other guys with 10 sons, this, that, and there's 10, you know, and then there's 10 brothers, and you know, it's a huge thing. So enough for 3 years, don't even bother. Because not that the yagya will take that much itself. I mean, how much can you throw into that fire? But you have to give that much in charity. That's the point. You know, Nanda Baba is giving 2 million cows. So these things aren't small. They're about, you know, serious charity. That's the whole point. You know? You know, it's like we're thinking about charity, look at our wallet. You know, should I give the 50 or should I give the 100, you know. That, you know. Like this. This is about, you know. You're looking at this, you know, is he qualified? Okay, he gets 10,000 cows. He's okay, he's, you know, good Brahmin, okay, he only gets 1,000 cows. You know, that kind of stuff. No, you know.
We give him a puppy.
Yeah, give him a puppy. Give him a basket of fruit. Yeah. You know, not that it can't be on that, but it's just you don't do the Shrauta Yagyas and that kind of level of stuff unless you have that kind of wealth. Anybody can give in charity and do like that. So whatever little they have, it doesn't matter. So that benefit is there for everybody. Mm-hmm. But for those who do these big things, it has to be done big. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's not that this is that big where, you know, you do and what do you call it? You make that splash. It keeps on going. You know? It's huge. Yes.
Kim said that this is the reason they are forbidden in Kali Yuga, because people are not qualified.
They're not qualified. Well. The Brahmins aren't qualified. The first thing is the Brahmins aren't qualified. Because if the Brahmins were qualified, that then they could train people and then see if they were qualified. You wouldn't be able to do it unless you had that and you had to follow all those things. Because when these things happen, then whoever's the head priest, what he says goes. It's not like nowadays, well, you know, okay, we have to have this. Well, I don't know. It's like, okay, we're going to do the deities, you know, we're going to do the Shayanadivas, so therefore we need 1,000 kilos of grain. Then what am I going to do with that? I can't do anything with that. That's stupid. You know, I'm going to get you, you know, 10 kilos of grain. Okay, so we won't do for the big deities, we'll do for the small deities. No, no, what's that? We have to make a show. This is preaching, Prabhu. You know, we have to have the big deities do this. It's like that. So you have these, and then what do they go on? The beds, they won't make the beds, so you hire the things from, you know, that they use for feeding people. You know, the caterers, they have these wooden things with the little rickety legs that you put the little things in and set them up like that. That's what you get. And then you kind of take a handful and just sprinkle it on. And they're happy. They're thinking, yeah, this is great. Like that. That's why in this age is that the Brahmins aren't there to train them, and the people are, you know, as unqualified. Sorry?
Sufficient amount of wealth is also required.
Yeah, of course. But that's the part of the qualification, no? But, you know, who has that kind of wealth? You know, so I'm saying, you know, maybe you know, a few billionaires could do it because they don't mind giving away, you know, so many billions.
Yes.
You know, because they got so many left. You know, so that's the kind of thing that this is the, you know, for those who are on that level, then they do this stuff. Even that, we don't hear about we hear about the rich ones that are known. We don't hear about the rich ones that are not known. Right. Huh? No. It's just that they're so rich, they're in another category. Like, you know, the sheikhs and stuff like that. You know, we hear about billionaires and woo, you know, and they're down there a few, 4 or 5 billion, then they get up to 50, 60, and then they wake up in the morning and they're down to 5 or 6 again, you know, because the stocks move and all that. We're talking about the trillionaires, you know, but because they only move in that, it's not something you can do, you know. You own a country and you own all the oil wells, then you're in that. Yeah, so it's not something that a regular businessman buy. You know, you can't start in your garage and become a billionaire. So therefore, you know, they don't talk about that. You know, because the idea is that, you know, what's obtainable. So this is that. It's just the way it goes. You know, like that, you know. You know, and all the ones in Texas have already been found. So, you know, that's not going to work. So. Okay. Because there are no yagyic Brahmins, that's the main thing, because they can train the other people to be qualified. All yagyas are forbidden. Right? That means these kind of yagyas, karmakanda and all that. So even on small, karmakanda technically shouldn't be done. All these. In other words, the nitya, the ones that are supposed to be done as a regular thing, and that are part of your duties, the samskaras and these kind of things, that is done because it's the whole samskar. But the kamyaka, the ones that you don't need to do, you're doing them because of the particular material benefit you want to do, they're not allowed. You know, like the putra kameshti, all these ones like that. You can't do that because there it's had to be the Brahman so qualified. They do the yajna, and then you get whatever it is, the mango or the sweet rice, and the wife eats that, she gets pregnant. And if she does something stupid with it, then whoever it was, they get pregnant. I think there was one somebody who came along and ate it, some guy, he got pregnant. You know, so, you know, we don't have those kind of Brahmins. So you have those Brahmins, then you can do, but not in this age. Those are Nityahomas. They're all part of the deity worship. We're teaching it from the Pancharatrik thing, though we're using Gopal Bhakti Goswami's, the Vedic method, because that's where the yajna is from. But that's given to us by Gopal Bhakti Goswami. You know, Prabhupada taught us the yajnas, and then he recommended Sakriya Sardipika, and there he explains how to do the yajna. So that's just part of that. We're talking about these Brahmins. Even that takes so much qualification. It means you see, the boys do it, they just sit down, start going, it just moves, flows through. No one looks at anything except for the boy chanting the mantras for the offering. But the technical ritual, no one's looking at anything. Right? They're just, you know, there to make sure that they're in the right place, don't miss a mantra or something like that. But technically, they don't really need it. You know what I'm saying? But as far as the ritual goes, there is no looking at a book in that. So if they have to look at a book and do it, technically you're not supposed to do that. Right? Yajna is supposed to be done by someone, or puja is supposed to be done by someone who doesn't have to look at the book. Like that. So you see a difference. You have that devotee, he does that, sits down that, you know, kind of mumbles some mantras, this, that. Everyone's sitting around, bored as anything. And that's why in this age you don't do these yajnas. But when they go through like that nicely, then it has the spiritual significance, but it also has that cultural. So it's inspiring. But if one guy's sitting there and mumbling through and looking at this and that and trying to figure out what it is and I hate that and, you know, stuff like that, then it's kind of like, you know, hey, you know, I could go chant Hare Krishna about it. You know? So that's the whole thing. It's training. You know, so it's like, you know, to do this, then you have to, you know, anybody can do, but let's say to your temple president, and then you have to go to a professional management course. Like that. You know, it doesn't make sense. It's a lower thing, and you have to have so many. But the higher thing, though, that anybody, we don't care. So it's a strange, but true. The only yajna recommended in this age is Sankirtana yajna. Yajyai Sankirtana prayer yajanti hi sumedha saha. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.5.32. Yajna is meant to satisfy Vishnu. Yajna tat karma non yatra loko yam karma bandhanaha. Bhagavad Gita 3.9. Because in this age there are no qualified Brahmins, people should perform yajna by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Yajyai Sankirtana prayer yajanti hi sumedha saha. Life is meant for yajna, and yajna is performed by the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So Sankirtan means it's part of the mission, it's about pleasing Krishna. So therefore all these big karmakandas, they're not allowed, because they have to be perfect. If one, like, literally one syllable, it's not, oh, you know, don't be so fit. No, one syllable is wrong, you will not get the benefit. It's just like that. So they have to be so called. So they won't be. So in this age, it's there. So the only yajna is Sankirtan yajna, which means to please Vishnu. So then anything within the Sankirtan yajna that's being done to please the Lord, that's going to allow you. So from that aspect, then the deity worship and the yajnas and all these are going on. Because they're part of the Sankirtan mission. Because they have their place and they help. Yes.
Some say that devotees having problems with the Gayatri mantras and not really advancing in that area is because of lack of training and also lack of qualifications still from there.
You could say, but it's more the devotion, because if the devotion's there, then they will have that focus and everything, and it'll work nice. So it's On the material platform, you can't take something, one thing, and make it into something else. Like I can't take that bamboo fence and make it into lasagna. Right? You know, at least not for us. The goats might eat it. They might be really happy. But, you know what I'm saying? So the point is that if someone doesn't have, by material karma, the nature of a dwija, then on the material platform, there is no training that you could do for them that they would be qualified materially to chant Gayatri. Mm-hmm. It's just like you take someone who's not a businessman, you could send them to the best MBA courses in the world, everything like that, they'll never become a businessman. Same with the manager, they're not a manager. You can't do anything to make them into a manager. Someone's not a musician, can't carry a tune in a bucket. Doesn't matter. You do send him to the best schools in Vienna, and he still won't be a minister. So the material platform, what you have, is what you got. That's it. It's not going to change. You may appreciate it, this and that, develop, and it might, for future life. That's another thing. Like that. So it's only through going through whatever is necessary to that, then it may go. But it's not that by training in it you'll get it. Right? Does that make sense? It's by the particular piety that develops these things. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So, then, that means that what's the only qualification? Is through. So the soul is qualified. Yes. But the conditioned nature may not be. Mm-hmm. So then, only by the performance of devotional service, that done being sincerely, then, by that, all the good qualities of the demigods are there. That means then they're qualified to chant Gayatri. So that's why you get the holy name first, which is the higher element, and you get the mantras that require material ability second. Even though, so we say, oh, it's a higher thing, but what is actually there? It's higher because it required more devotional focus. You had to be more fixed in devotional service to come to the platform of being qualified to chant the Gayatri. Right? But you see, let's say, those born in Brahmin families, they may have those material qualifications. But then it becomes spoiled because they become proud. Mm-hmm. So then the Vaishnavas, because they're not proud, therefore they develop that qualification and they're not proud about it. So then they can keep progressing. While the Brahmin who's become proud, then he starts to lose that position. That's why it says, free from pride, free from false ego. Mm. They're not envious of others. So the Brahmin, he comes, he has nothing, he's not envious of the king who has everything. Because he knows what a headache that is, and all the entanglement that's there, and he's perfectly happy doing what he does. So that kind of qualification means, if you want to be able to function better with the Gayatri, means you have to become more focused on hearing and chanting, more serious about your devotional service. That's the only qualification. There is, you get means material qualification, you cannot teach it to someone who doesn't have the principal qualification. You know what I'm saying? So to make a kind of, okay, this course is open to anybody, and it has a particular material skill, and that you went through the course, and then afterwards, then you're qualified to do that thing, when the person who taught it can't do that thing. So then, right? Because in the Vedic, those who could do, they're the ones who taught. But in the modern academy, the joke is, those who can't do, they teach. Right? And then there's two various things. Those who can't teach, right? If you're into, the lower levels of education, they teach PE. PE? Physical education, right? Gym class and those things. Right? They're teachers, but... Or, if they're more into the academic field and all that, then those who can't teach, teach the teachers. So you have an inherent problem here. And that's being seen by the corporate world, that the kids who come out of the school, they're absolutely useless. I mean, absolutely. And they think because they have the degree, they're so qualified, and you can't teach them anything. It'd be easier to take, a teenager, a young teenager, like with some interest and all that, you could teach them actually quicker. You know what I'm saying? So it's they're going to teach you at the job anyway. So it's just, if you've gone through the course, you've got good degrees, you've put in this and that, then they can see, okay, there's some qualification that maybe we could do something with this person. But it's not that they walk in as it is and everything's great. You know, those ones then, as you know, 10 years experience, 5 years experience, those like that, then those are ones you may walk in and kind of do it. But if it's not, you just, then it's only there to tell, okay, the guy's serious. So it's that's the difference between the modern kind of academy and the Vedic. Because the Vedic, it's the people who are qualified, they're the ones who teach. Because otherwise you can't get them, because it's a practical thing, right? Because if you don't know how to do it, then how would you spend a day involved with the practical doing it? You know what I'm saying? Because it wouldn't work. But the modern, you can sit in the classroom, teach the things, and never actually... Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. They even joke about this. I read a joke, they say, for a guy, forget whatever you learned in the college. I haven't been to college. Okay, we cannot hire you because we need educated people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like that. I've always heard, I remember you go into, I can't remember, not junior high, but in high school. When you get into high school and you get into that, they tell, forget whatever you learned before, now we're going to teach you this. Then you go through all that, learn all that, then you get to university, forget all that, then you're going to learn this. Then you go for the postgraduate, then it's definitely forget anything you learned. And then but in the Vedic, it just builds. It's the same education. It's not that they don't create things for kids to do. It's just what adults do is what you teach to a kid. But you teach that aspect that they can. You know, like that. Kids, young kids can memorize anything. It doesn't matter what it is, they can memorize it. Right? Adults then, you know, trying to remember what your name is, what you had for lunch yesterday, what you had for lunch today. You know, like that is a problem. Kids can remember anything. Like that. Teenagers can learn any skill. Like that. You know, you say it's all this is adult, this and that. No, a teenager, especially, they can learn anything. Yeah. You know, it's just like you give a skateboard to the 13-year-old and you give the skateboard to the 30-year-old. You know, they've never skated. You know, come back in a week and... The kid will be doing all kinds of far out tricks and this and that, and the 30-year-old will be in the hospital. Right? So that's the thing. They learn it. So that's all the skills, but all the technical philosophical things, the esoteric, that's what then starts on 16. So that's what's supposed to be done. So now you've learned the mantras and that, then you can learn the skill, and then you can learn, you know, all, you know, what's going on and all the technical things. Now the principles of all that, what it's for and how it pleases Krishna, that you teach all the way through. Yes. But the actual material aspect of being able to use, you know, the memory, to be able to use, you know, the, how you say, mental and sensual coordination and all that, and to be able to deal with the finer points, you know, logic and all that, that then you have different ages. But they're only learning adult knowledge. In the Vedic, there is no such thing as children's knowledge. It's always adult knowledge. That's why you don't have to have people that are sitting around and work out new ways of doing things, because you don't have children, you only have adult knowledge. You know, it's been taught for, you know, thousands of years, and it works, so you just have to do that. So, yeah, it's slightly different.
Gayatri Mantra is a Vedic mantra, and it's been said over here that one must be expert in chanting.
Where did it say expert?
Completely expert in chanting the Vedic hymns. So,
but we're talking about the Shuktas and that. We're not talking about our Gayatris, which basically for us are Pancharatra. Only the Brahma Gayatri we would take as Vedic.
It
means they're all from the Upanishads and all that, but they're coming to us through the Pancharatrik, so we're only using them in the Pancharatrik context.
Okay.
Right? Does that make sense? So they're slightly different. the Brahma Gayatri is the only one that then is seed. Does that make sense? In other words, the actual Brahminical qualifications are required for all of them, but it's the it's just that is on the Brahma Gayatri. But to have the devotion is required for the Pancharatric ones. Right? Because that's actually a transcendental initiation. The Brahma Gayatri is not a transcendental initiation. It's considered spiritual, but it's not devotional. It means we use it in context of, but someone could have Brahminical qualifications, get Upanayanam, and be able to chant and do those basic Brahminical activities. But they were not, they're not qualified for being equivalent to devotional. Does that make sense?
Yes,
you know, so it's like the person gets Upanayanam, he's a Brahmin. But he can't do worship in a Pancharatra temple. It's a higher worship. So technically, that's the Tuija. So in the Vedic, the Tuija would mean the Shrauta Yagas. Because that's what they would be doing. But when you're talking about the devotional, then the Tuija means Pancharatra. Because Pancharatra is basically, you could say, formalized Bhagavat, you know, devotion. How to worship the Lord when you don't have love for him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, Bhagavat, you have love for him, therefore you don't have to, there's no ritual. But you can see is they're quite happy doing all the rituals. But the difference is they're trying to please Krishna. Nanda Maharaj, for the sake of the affluence of his own son Krishna, that's where it started. So Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja. So here, totally surrendered to Krishna. Then he's engaging religion, in his case, charity, worshipping the Brahmins, doing yajnas, chanting the mantras, all these different things. He's using all those religious principles for the point of sake of affluence of his own son, Krishna. That's the meaning of Sarvadharma. They're able to... It's about Krishna first. Then we're engaging the rituals as is suitable for the occasion. Okay. But when we're starting with the ritual, then that's not sarva dharma, but it's that job. Right? Because it's sarva padi dinir muktam. You have to give up all those things. Okay, so therefore the yajna is the Sankirtan yajna, and anything that's part of the culture of, it means for the practice of the Sankirtan Yajna and is part of the culture of those who are involved in the Sankirtan Yajna, then that's part of Sankirtana. Therefore, the deity worship, the performance of the Yajnas and Samskars is given to us by the Acharyas, because they're the ones who gave us the books and they're the ones who recommend. You know, it's not that, oh, okay, that's for before. No, they're talking about this today. So, those are all the culture of those who practice the Sankirtan mission. So in that way, then the yajna is there. But that, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Verses 18-33, the story of Trinavarta. Sukadeva Goswami continued. One day, a year after Krishna's appearance, Mother Jashoda was putting her son on her lap. Patting her son on her. One day, a year after Krishna's appearance. Okay, so this was the previous one. The Shakatasura. Then is at 3 months. So now this is at 1 year. Was patting her son on her lap. But suddenly she felt the child to be heavier than a mountain peak. And she can no longer bear his weight. Footnote 8. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur assigns verse 18. To Bhagavad Arkamrita Mala, chapter 19, entitled The Perfection of the Mellow of Pure Love, the Unlimited Dimensions of Rasa, Siddha Prema Rasa, Rasa Garima, which is in the Prayojana section of the Thakur's book. Krishna also thought, Jashoda can only lift me a little, but I want to play in the sky. Right? She's just lifted him off the ground a little bit, onto her lap, but he's thinking, I want to play in the sky. Right? So this is not going to work.
Right.
Yeah.
This Prayojana again, because of her affection?
Yes, because she doesn't see, you know, here is you have the unlimited, you know, personality of Godhead. And so naturally he's, you know, there is no weight to he is weight, you know. But she's keeping on her lap, patting him, trying to take care. So all these are just, as it says, the unlimited dimensions of rasa. So therefore we're seeing it from different angles. How Mother Yashoda, that previous one, is how Nanda Baba was thinking. Then we saw before, then, you know. Desiring like this, Krishna let the Asura Trinavarta approach. Footnote 9. Srila Prabhupada writes, Lala Yanti, sometimes a mother lifts her child, and when the child falls in her hands, the child laughs, and the mother also enjoys pleasure. Thus it seems that Krishna desired to be thrown higher into the air, but understood that his mother would not find pleasure in such an adventure. Thus he inspired her to put him down and remove herself from the danger. Right, because they'll lift them up a little bit and then bring them down, or even throw them just a touch. You know, you're just throwing a few inches and then catching them. You know, while you catch, you bring them down, so they feel like that they're, you know, so like that, yeah. So then they're enjoying that. But because he wants to really go up, then it will be dangerous. So then he let Trinavarta come, because then he can really go high up in the sky. And so again, it's like a human baby. They like doing these things, but since he's God, he does it in an amazing way. But it's still just being lifted up into the sky and then coming down. Sugadev Goswami continues.
Everything here is like a reflection.
There's a form of what is parental rasa. Krishna is tasting that, they're using that for him, so because of that, it gives unlimited pleasure. Here, we're using the same thing, but we're trying to use it for ourselves. Therefore, it gives limited pleasure. You know, it's just like we try to eat things to be happy, but it gives limited pleasure. You offer it to Krishna, then you eat, then it gives so much more pleasure. Right? So like that, it's not that it's something else. In the spiritual world, they eat, so here we won't eat. You know? Like that. No, it's the same thing. You do the same thing. Right? But because it's for yourself, then it may not have all the nice little finities to it. You know, because when we're thinking about ourselves, who wants to go, like we said before, who wants to go through 48 samskaras? Like that. But if it's just love for Krishna, it's parental rasa, what else are you going to be doing? So it's just one of the things that are done. That, and then doing all these little things, and feeding him, and, you know, so many aspects, and then correcting him, and, you know, bathing him, dressing him, putting him to rest, and all these different things, training. So these are just mediums in which to show affection for Krishna. But we want those same things, but for ourselves. You know, does that make sense? So we want to be the child, or we want to be the parent. Like that. Does that make sense? So that's the difference. Checking. Class is almost over, then you can all leave now. Quickly go back. It starts raining very seriously. Yes. Okay. Okay, Sugadeva Goswami continued, feeling the child to be as heavy as the entire universe, and therefore being anxious, thinking that perhaps the child was being attacked by some other ghost or demon, the astonished Mother Yashoda put the child down on the ground and began to think of Narayana. So when we say that heavy, it means literally. It wasn't just, oh, he's feeling a little heavy, and so, you know, it's just like, you know, the child wants to be carried. But, you know, they're 4 years old, they're a bit big, or five, or six. You know, no, you got to walk, and, you know, like that. We're not talking that kind of put them down because they're heavy. We're talking so heavy, she can't keep them on her lap. Therefore, she thinks some ghost or demon, there's something going wrong here. Right? Because otherwise, why would a baby feel so heavy that a mother can't hold the baby? You know, you never hear of that. Mothers can always hold the baby. Right? Especially at 1 year. Like that. So she began to think of Narayana, because then the Lord will, Vishnu will protect. Foreseeing disturbances, she called for the Brahmins to counteract this heaviness, and then she engaged in her other household affairs. Because then, That's the idea, you know, that she thought of Narayana and then engaged the Brahmins that they should take care, you know, that there's something strange here. So, like that. She had no alternative than to remember the lotus feet of Narayana, for she could not understand that Krishna was the original source of everything. Srila Prabhupada comments. Mother Jashoda did not understand that Krishna is the heaviest of all heavy things, and that Krishna rests within everything. Matstani sarvabhutani. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 9.4, Maya tatam idam sarvam jagat avyakta murtina. Krishna is everywhere in his impersonal form, and everything rests upon him. Nonetheless, na chaham teshva vastita. Krishna is not everywhere. Right? Krishna is a person. He's where he likes to be. Mm-hmm. It's all him. But where he is, that's according to what his pleasure. Because he's a person, but he is everything. Mm-hmm. You know, now if everything can rest on the Brahman, that means how heavy is the Brahman? Mm-hmm. Right? But because we think Brahman's quality list, we'll never think like that. You know, that. Okay. 7 times, yeah.
Would Brahman be heavy? Actually, would Brahman be heavy?
It's the heaviest. Otherwise, how do you... Means, if you have something heavy and you want to put it down, what do you put it on? Something light? You go into the refrigerator, get out your can of whipped cream, and quickly put a little mountain on the table, and then put down the bowling ball or something. Mm. But it's something heavier. So, therefore, Krishna is the heaviest, you know, he's of everything heavy, he's the heaviest. The heaviest of all heavy things. Right? But he, you know, and everything rests on him, so that's because of that. But as a person, then he takes the appropriate heaviness. Right? But he's so that's the point, is he's God, so we're trying to work out this in our little brain, and it's not going to work. Because being the source of everything, that means all contradictions are reconciled in him, because he is that one person.
That we have Bhagavatam to reconcile those, because it's the same contradiction that we have in Vedanta Sutra.
Yeah, no, it's always the same.
This is easy.
This is easy because of the aspect of the rasa, the sweetness. But actually, it's actually more difficult to understand, because scholars can get some grasp on Vedanta Sutra, but bhakti they can't necessarily, unless they're devotees. So actually, this is more technical than that. But because that's dry, it's not as appealing as this, which is, you know, full of rasa. Does that make sense? Yeah. Because that's why you see is some simple little point like this. Then there's so much discussions to actually show what is the devotion and what's the mechanical aspect. So we have to be able to discern between those two. Otherwise, we take it that the better we are at the mechanical aspect, mm-hmm. then the more advanced we are. Right? Because that's in the material world. You're doing something. You're a manager. Therefore, if you've been managing for more of the time, then, of course, then you're better at it. That's generally the concept. You know, or you're in music. The longer you've been at it, the better you are at it. So in general cases, that's the way it is. But then you see someone like Mozart, he was the court musician for the queen at 6 years old. Right? And much probably to the annoyance of all the 50, 60-year-old musicians in the court who used to have that position until the 6-year-old came along. You know? So that's the whole thing, is that ultimately, it's about who's the best at it. But the age means he at 6 years old has to respect all the other court musicians who are older. But then they have to respect him, that he's actually better at it than them. So that's the dual thing. But in the non-Vedic, it always goes one way. Even in the Vedic, people who don't understand the essential points try to make it go one way. But actually, it's always respect. You respect some of it. Because all things are potencies of Krishna. So therefore, any quality of opulence is Krishna. Therefore, it has to be respected. Mm-hmm. So whoever has anything, that has to be respected for that. But there's a hierarchy of what's considered a senior over, you know. So say, the Brahman, then what he knows, that's will be more than what the artist knows. like that. So that's the hierarchy. You know, it's art is one thing, then economics, then administration, and then the Brahmin. So that's how it goes up, and then that's there. So you could have a young Brahmin and older Shudra, but then he's respected for his age and his qualification in music, but the Brahmin's respected for, he actually knows a higher topic. So that's just how it works. Yes.
How can I understand that you always mentioned that the qualities whichever we see, it is the Brahman feature of the Lord, and elsewhere we also say that the Brahman has no qualities.
What's that?
The Brahman Jyoti.
Means it has no material qualities. But the Brahman effulgence is the effulgence of Krishna's qualities. His qualities are so special that they're effulgent. That effulgence is the Brahman. Therefore, we say it has no material quality. It's qualityless. Or we say it's qualityless because all qualities are there in every aspect. But everything is built on the Brahman, because anything that has a particular manifestation of quality, all it's doing is manifesting that particular aspect. But the quality of Brahman is unlimited. So we say greatness, it's the unlimited greatness. So we're manifesting something like a mountain, and it's great. But it's only part of the glory of Brahman. Therefore, you can therefore say it's qualityless, because it's unlimited. Is that what it says? Yeah, so like that then is there. So this idea that Brahma has no qualities, because to say it has no qualities means that's a quality. It's unlimited, that's a quality. It's unchanging, that's a quality. It has no qualities, it's a quality. Like if I say something has no color, that's a quality of it. You know, say, yeah, bring me the glass that has no color in it. You know, like that. You know, so it's, they're saying there's no quality, but there is qualities. But they finesse those because it, you know, they just, okay, there's a couple, but we won't worry about those. Is that what it says? You know, it's just like the guy comes into the guy's house, and the dog, you know, bites him on his, you know, leg and won't let go, and the house owner says, no, he's a nice dog, you know, don't worry, he's just, you know. Yeah, it's like that. So like that, they're overlooked due to their attachment and affection for, you know, Brahman and emerging into Brahman, so then they overlook these faults, that, you know, according to their philosophy of faults.
Maharaj, when we speak of Krishna being impersonal, he has an impersonal form, he is present everywhere, and Krishna is not everywhere. So, speaking of the Achintya,
yes, because he is everywhere, but he as a person is not everywhere. You know, it's just like the powerful man, his influence is spreading everywhere, but where is he at the moment where he feels it's best to be? Right, so he's in his palace with his family. That's the best place to be. Or he's in the court, or he's out checking the troops and, you know, everything like that. Or he's out on the battlefield, or he's out spying, and, you know, himself to just check that the spies are doing their duties. You know what I'm saying? So wherever he feels is the best application of his influence, that's where he is. But his influence is everywhere. So that's the whole point, is that Krishna, that hears that that king is limited on his influence, right? So that's theirs. You know, it's like you have the king, and it's only a small little place, or it's bigger. He's emperor, right? You know, who is that? Louis was emperor. Who else? The Caesar's emperor, and Augustus, and then you had
Prince Ferdinand.
Oh yes, the German. He was emperor. And then our curly-haired man, yeah. Alexander was emperor. China, they have their emperor, you know. But the thing is how actually much did they deal with? Just their area, you know. Means within their area, then there was the whole thing. So anybody else in that area, then they were the kings, and he was the emperor. But, you know, how you say, they're over there in Europe, but they're not the kings in China, and the emperor in China, he's not, has no influence over Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, and none of them have influence over the Zulu Walla down south. You know, so it's just that's the fun. And then you have the Vedic emperors. They were emperor of the world, and sometimes even beyond. So it means that the Bharata Khanda that we're on, but sometimes they had influence beyond into the Kanara, Varsha, the Kanara Varsha, and the next one up, or something like that, like Kimpurufya. Yeah, generally those two are right next to it. Yeah, but some of them do, but generally you don't. You find a couple of them were mentioned that they had that influence, but most don't. You know, it's just the seven islands and the seven oceans, like that. But then some of them, that seven islands, seven oceans means the whole of Bhumandala. You know, otherwise, it just means on this part, Bharata Khanda. But some of them had more influence even on Jambudvipa. Right? Then you have Indra. But then Indra's influence is only up to a particular point, and after that, then they don't get involved. Like that one area, they say it's just after the last, I think, what do you call it? The last area, the last ocean on Bhumandala, then there's that area, it's just golden. You know, the demigods just don't go there because you can't see anything. You drop it, you can't find it. It's just, you know, so no one goes there, so they don't have influence. But past the Loka-Loka, they don't bother. What's below Bhumandala, they don't control. The demons, they don't go down there and control. As long as the demons stay down there, they're fine. The battles are when the demons come up. Right? Demigods generally don't go down there. Like that. You know, so they don't. Their influence is limited, and then what's above Indra's place, that he doesn't control. So Maharjana, Tapa, and Satya, he doesn't control. Indra doesn't control at all. It's not his area. But that's all the Brahmins. They're above the Kshatriya. Right, so then, you know, so you have everybody has something. There's a limit to what they're doing, like that. You know, so. But Krishna, then, he's king of everything. It's all his. There's nothing that's not his. So your influence may be so great, but still the person is in one place. Is that something? Okay. Mother Yashoda was unable to understand this philosophy because she is dealing with Krishna as his real mother by the arrangement of Yoga Maya. Not understanding the importance of Krishna, she could only seek shelter of Narayan for Krishna's safety and call the Brahmanas to counteract the situation. So then Krishna likes this. You take care of anything with the Brahmins. So then anything to take care of him, and then anything to take care of the Brahmins. Because for Krishna, then that's respect of the Brahmins and the Vaishnavas is more important than respect for himself. So then anything that you see, all these things, they do nice things for Krishna, always include the cows, the Brahmins, the Vaishnavas, like that. Sukadeva Goswami continued. While the child was sitting on the ground, a demon named Trinavarta, who was a servant of Kamsa's, came there as a whirlwind at Kamsa's instigation, and very easily carried the child away into the air. Footnote 10. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura assigns verse 20 to Bhagavad Arkarumi Chimala, chapter 19 entitled The Perfection of Mellow of Pure Love, The Unlimited Dimensions of Rasa, Siddha Prema Rasa, Rasa Garima, which is in the Prayojana section of the Thakura's book. So it's by the arrangement of Yoga Maya and all these different things for Krishna's pleasure. Because remember, is that the whole point of Prayujan is Krishna's pleasure. Why does Krishna allow this to happen, that he wants to go up in the air? Because as a baby, he wants to, you know, go up and down in the air. So then this is then. So therefore, that other aspect of that Mother Yashoda became so heavy that Mother Yashoda couldn't carry him and put him down is because of the same thing. It's his pleasure. So we see is these things are happening not because of some material arrangement. Yeah. They're not by the modes of nature. They're not by the planets. Right? They're not by anybody's management or organization. They're simply because of Krishna's pleasure. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's what makes them prayojana. Mm-hmm. So you see is these sections. So you either see the devotee expressing their love for Krishna, which then we see in some places, and there we see how Krishna is doing something for his own pleasure, and which will include the devotees and bring pleasure to the devotees. You know, or a combination, that interaction. So that's what it means, these unlimited dimensions of rasa. It has all these different aspects.
Maharaj, Krishna is using Tinavakta for his own pleasure.
Yes.
In that sense, the demon is serving Krishna.
Yes, everybody's serving Krishna. They can't avoid that. But here he gets...
Yes.
He said, he was making a point that... the flotilla, okay. Only two today. Yeah. So that the demon Krishna wants to go up in the sky, so Trinavarta technically is actually serving him. So that's the meaning of all living entities are servants of Krishna. Just some are serving directly, some are serving indirectly. You know, some are serving really indirectly. You know, like that. Srila Prabhupada comments, Krishna's heaviness was unbearable for the child's mother, but when Trinavartasura came, he immediately carried the child away. This was another demonstration of Krishna's inconceivable energy. When the Trinavarta demon came, Krishna became lighter than the grass, so the demon could carry him away. So yes, so he became very light, and so the demon also become very... See, as if he's very heavy, the demon, how high will he go up in the air? Right, but if Krishna's like light like grass, then he'll be very proud and go way up into the air and, you know, like that. And then Krishna will have more fun. This was Ananda Chinmaya Rasa, Krishna's blissful transcendental pleasure. Right, so that's the point. So that's what we're trying to do. Prayojana is generating Krishna's pleasure. Sukadeva Goswami continued, covering the whole land of Gokul with particles of dust, that demon acting as a strong whirlwind covered everyone's vision and began vibrating everywhere with a greatly fearful sound. Srila Prabhupada comments, Trinavartasura assumed the form of a whirlwind and covered with a dust storm the whole tract of land known as Gokula, so that no one could see even the nearest thing. In a Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, Trinavarta represents the false pride produced by useless scholarship, which gives rise to wrangling debates and arguments, dry reasoning and dry logical indulgences in the association of people who are attached to such things. Because that's coming from the mode of passion. Even though you're using the scholarship, which is a brahminical thing or an intellectual thing, but you're using it basically for dry arguments and reasoning, so it's a kind of debate. It's like fighting. So it's therefore in the category of passion. It may be goodness. It means it may be, if you take each of the three modes and divide by three, right? So you have ignorance, passion, ignorance, goodness, passion, ignorance, passion, passion, goodness, like this. Then Kshatriyas will be in passion and passion. These kind of Brahmins and this kind of waste of time, that's considered goodness of passion. But it's still, that's why you see all these people generally are with the kings. Because there, it's in the court, it's a big thing, it's prestigious, you know, like that. You'll also get so much benefit from it. You'll be recognized as such a great scholar. You know, you'll have that facility being taken care of by the kings and that, and then you can study, devote yourself to the study, so you can be even better at arguing, like that. So, you know, the tendency is like that. They tend to go like that. But it's about winning, it's about the debate. It's not about Siddhanta. That's why Krishna says of the 16 parts of Nyaya, yeah, then he's Siddhanta. Yeah. Otherwise, here they're just interested in winning, yeah, you know. So that's Nigrahastan. Where you say the final point, the other person can't answer back, then Yes.
But how acharyas determine that this particular demon represent that? Because there is apparently no connection between the two.
Oh, you mean, so if someone uses scholarship, then they use that whirlwind of all, like, wrangling debates and just, you know, people can't see, they blind you with all of their knowledge and all that, and they themselves are totally blind, right? You know what I'm saying? Because that's the whole thing. It's when it starts and you have to whip up this whole thing to, because it's about false ego, you know? So either, in some way they just make it where you can't answer back. So it's produced useless scholarship. False pride produced by useless scholarship. So they go together. Real pride, being a real scholar and having the proper attitude of I'm servant of Krishna. That then you like see like Jiva Goswami. Then they have they're the greatest scholars. There has been in the when we talk about contemporary time, it means the last so many, you know, whatever is known. Like that means there hasn't been no, you know, scholar like Jiva Goswami. You know, as we mentioned before, is that Ramanuja is an eternal associate of the Lord. So is Madhva. So is Nimbarka, Vishnu Swami, like this. But the Ramanuja, we mentioned that Ramanuja priest, or no scholar, was saying that, you know, of course they're in the Ramanuja line. They studied that. They know it very well, and they're scholars. And the work of Ramanujacharya is extremely scholarly, therefore he could defeat all so many other scholars. But he said, if you work at it, you know, people then take what he said, go back and then analyze, and then, you know, using their false, you know, wrangling and debates and dry reasoning, they can find some faults that they can play with. And if they're better at the logical process, then they'll win the argument. Not that they actually came up with anything of value. Because what Ramanujacharya would have said would have been perfect and correct. But as Lord Chaitanya showed, he went down to the river when they, because they're all logicians, you know, they're all learning the Navanyaya, that's the specialty of Navadri. So then they go down and he'd start, you know, debates. That would be their fun. And he'd defeat somebody, and then he would defeat his own philosophy. So he could just keep going. Because there's always finer and finer points of logic. But it's not about logic. It's about logic's being used as a tool to establish Siddhanta. So he's showing that, you know, just whoever's better at logic wins. Not that it's actually the truth. Mm-hmm. Right? So makes sense. Mm-hmm. So we were there. Okay, so people could do that with Ramanujacharya's points. But he said that he and so many scholars himself, they really appreciate reading Jiva Goswami, even though he's not their line. Because it doesn't matter what logic you apply, you cannot twist the meaning different than what Jiva Goswami wrote. It's so perfectly written. We just think, oh, he wrote that. But it's so perfectly written. These scholars, top scholars, you can't juggle the word. What? Not one syllable, nothing. That's why then Prabhupada says that he is, you know, the greatest scholar. Mm-hmm. Like that. So it's like, you know, so we won't see, you know, you only need one. Like that. So therefore, logic of his sandarbhas and that, there is no better logic. The presentation, there isn't better. Like that.
It's very logical, and with different evidences, and different words that he defines is so perfect that nobody can just answer that. You know? It's like,
yes.
It just gives a conclusion.
Yes.
It's very nice.
So, you can get into it just as a useless thing because you like to fight. Mm. Like that. So, you know, people get pleasure out of that. They find it fun. They just like to fight just to fight. You know? Some, it doesn't matter who wins, they just want to fight. Even you won, you defeated them, they'll just come up with something else just to continue the fight, just because they like fighting. You know? Or they'll just say anything stupid just so to continue, just to make you more angry so it continues. And they just find pleasure in it.
We call them trolls now.
Trolls, yes. Okay, that's the new word, troll. That's the troll, they just like to argue.
Usually on the neck.
Yes. Okay, I heard that, yeah, the relationship to... Somebody come and started harassing you know, the politicians and stuff like that. They call them trolls. So they just like argue. Yeah. I think a lot of times, journalists tend to be trolls. They just say things and twist it out of context.
They need to provoke you.
Yeah, like that. So they just... Okay. So Trinavarta represents the false pride produced by useless scholarship, which gives rise to wrangling debates and arguments, dry reasoning and dry logical indulgence in the association of people who are attached to such things. So in other words, purely mundane. It produces controversy, which is disloyal to the path of pure bhakti, right? So, no, but this one this, and that, but this one said this, and now you're saying that. Why bring that up? Try to work it out. He's, okay, then it's like this, so how does that apply in this? It's not about learning, it's about creating this controversy. It's about, does that make sense? And that creates a taste. So that's what Trinavarta represents. Whatever will create this controversy, whatever can take it out of context, whatever will create a different way of looking so that now you have two ways so there can be an argument. Because you're explaining something very nicely, but someone will take it out of context to create a second position so that just there could be an argument.
So now this is very common now.
Yes, it's very common. Because people don't want siddhanta, because siddhanta means you have to surrender. They like speculation because then, if it's speculation, then whatever I'm thinking is good. But if it's no, this is siddhanta, so what you're thinking has to be brought in line with that is not popular. Like that. So you see it's more outgoing. It was always there, as we said, that was what happened with Socrates. Yes. You know, that same thing. They don't want siddhanta. Yes. Because then their speculations become law. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, no, there's already an existing eternal law that you have to adjust with. They don't want to do. They want to set their own standards. So this becomes the position. Whatever it is, you take it, put it into a bad light. There's a saying in English, give a dog a bad name and then hang them. Mm-hmm. Like that. So you just take something and then switch it into something else and show it from a bad light. And so, and so then it seems like it. But you just, if you can see where the root is and how they've taken it off, then you just stick your course and just show how that's not proper. And it really freaks them out because nobody does that. They all emotionally respond and then they're in their trap. But if you don't get trapped, like Prabhupada wouldn't get trapped in these things. And so people didn't, so they just had the respect. Because that takes qualities. So that's the point, is devotion. Pure bhakti, then you don't get affected by this. Mm-hmm. But if there's any impurity, you get affected by this. Mm-hmm. Like that, because it's based on attachment.
And can you say that the different beings that we saw and the Amartas that they represent, you know, Dronavat is very dangerous because we'll be calling the darkness of Maya or the Buddhism, then, you know, which is very dangerous.
Means any of all these different demons are dangerous. They're all different in situations. But this one will be dangerous for those for this particular thing. Because some people are not into scholarship and that, so this may not be a problem for them. You know what I'm saying? This is not... But all the demons are there, because then all these things you go through, and even if there's some subtle aspects, it's removed from the heart. But for any individual, you might find different demons are more prominent. Like that. So that makes sense. Yeah. It produces. Okay. All these dry logical. It produces controversy, which is disloyal to the path of pure bhakti, such as Mayavad and Buddhism. Mm-hmm. It is the breeding place of demoniac, sinful philosophies. Mm-hmm. So coming up with these things, then you create that there's two things, right? And so because of that controversy, then how do you bring out pure bhakti? Mm-hmm. Because then it's, well, you have this and you have that, but you're speaking on pure bhakti. Mm-hmm. But they present the other thing as if it's something equal. Mm-hmm. You know? Well, you have Western culture, you have Indian culture, it's just a culture of the world, so, you know, why is it that you're favoring this over that? They take it out of the context. No, the point is, you know, India is the place where all the path of pure devotion was given and practiced. And so therefore the tradition of those great personalities who practice pure devotion, that's what we're following. Then to take it out of the context of just then, okay, well, those who aren't devotees and following the Vedic, and they may be, but that's material, and it says here the material. But in the process, they're trying to get rid of the proper practice by devotees.
Mm-hmm.
Because being not from India, they don't want to follow it because they're attached, like that here, they're who are attached to such things. Therefore, dry logical arguments, wrangling debates, false pride, useless scholarship, all that comes into play to establish these, you know, these sinful philosophies. So Mayavad Buddhism, you know, any of these kind of things that come up that are against the principle of pure devotion, they come up because of this useless scholarship. They're intelligent, you know, but it's being misapplied. So therefore then so by dry logical argument, by dry reasoning, then someone may be very good at it. You know, it's just like you have all those French, you know, scholars and all that. People couldn't defeat them. But it didn't mean that they were right. It just means that they were better at arguments and debates. And so therefore then they became established as the, you know, the scholars. Like that. So that's the whole thing, is that you have all these kind of people who come up with their philosophies. But it doesn't mean that it's of value. So Trinavarta is, you know, then by killing this demon, it removes that aspect from the heart. These coverings, you know, this you have whirlwind of ignorance, where you can't actually see things as they are. Because what is Braj? Braj is the purest, pure unalloyed bhakti. And what did Trinavarta do? He covered it. So then pure bhakti becomes covered by this useless scholarship. Right? Because it sounds logical and it sounds that. It sounds scientific and it sounds all these things, when in reality it doesn't actually, it's not useful for anything. Lord Krishna becomes moved by the humility of his devotees, who carefully avoid this fault, and he strangles the demon and removes the thorn from his devotees' endeavors in devotional service. So the devotees are trying to be humble, they're trying to practice, so then Krishna will remove that. Okay. So then it just comes, it's just one of those things that by practicing devotional service, it will go with time. According to the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, in his last life he was a king of Pandyadesha named Sahasraksha, who was cursed by Durvasa Muni for appearing naked before him while the king was enjoying with his 1,000 wives. He was cursed to live on earth for 100,000 years and then be killed by Lord Krishna. Right? So then he got, you know, ultimately a benefit.
Interesting. That
has
nothing to do with philosophy or arguments. The king.
Yeah, but, you know, he probably had a million reasons why it was okay. Yeah. Sukadeva Goswami continued, "For a moment, the whole pasturing ground was overcast with dense darkness from the dust storm." What is happening? Dense darkness from the dust storm.
It is dark.
Yeah. No. I'm saying about all the alliteration.
Oh, dense darkness.
Because I remember in high school, oh, they freak out if you put alliteration in there. Okay, they have that. They just still do that. Yeah, like that. You know, it's fine. It's nuts.
And, considered literary embellishment.
It is, yeah. But the point is that's what I was saying. The school teachers that can't do it, then they tell you, they give you bad marks for that. And Mother Jashoda was unable to find her son where she had placed him. Because of the, right, because when the storm came up, she would go to the spot to pick him up. He's not there, but she can't see either. Because of the bits of sand thrown about by Trinavarta, people could not see themselves or anyone else, unless they were illusioned and disturbed. Right? So that's the point. They're illusioned and disturbed by this whole storm of bogus argumentation. Like that. Because the dust storm stirred up by the strong whirlwind, Mother Jashoda could find no trace of her son, nor could she understand why. Thus she felt that, you know, she didn't even know, you know, what had happened. She didn't know he just wanted to go for a ride. Right? Thus she fell down on the ground like a cow who has lost her calf and began to lament very pitifully. When the force of the dust storm and the winds subsided, Mother Jashoda's friends, the other gopis, approached Mother Jashoda, hearing her pitiful crying. Not seeing Krishna present, they too felt very much aggrieved and joined Mother Jashoda in crying, their eyes full of tears. Srila Prabhupada comments, this attachment of the gopis to Krishna is wonderful and transcendental. The center of all activities of the gopis was Krishna. When Krishna was there, they were happy. And when Krishna was not there, they were unhappy. Okay, so all these things, as long as Krishna is the center, like you see at a later point, it'll come up. I think it's mentioned in Nectar Devotion, so whether it will come up here, is that after, when Krishna had gone to Mathura, then there's a conversation between Nanda and Jashoda, and she's lamenting that Krishna's not there. And then he's telling, you foolish woman, right? Why are you lamenting? He's right here. So he's hallucinating and saying, you know, so it's just the whole point is Krishna is the center. So one's saying it's like this, the other one's saying it's like that. But the point is that about Krishna is the center. Because of that, that's the perfection. Right? Sukadeva Goswami continued, having assumed the form of a forceful whirlwind, the demon Trinavarta took Krishna very high in the sky. But when Krishna became heavier than the demon had to stop his force and could go no further, right? Because, I mean, there's a limit to how fun it is to go up into the sky. You know, so you go up how much high was there, and when Krishna's happy, then now he becomes so heavy that, you know. Srila Prabhupada comments, here is a competition in yogic power between Krishna and Trinavarta Asura. By practicing mystic yoga, asuras generally attain some perfection in the eight cities, or perfections, namely anima, lagima, mahima, prapti, prakamya, ishitva, vasitva, and kama vasayita. But although a demon may acquire such powers to a very limited extent, he cannot compete with the mystic power of Krishna. For Krishna is Yogeshwar, the source of all mystic power. Yatra Yogeshwaro Harihi. Bhagavad Gita 18:78. No one can compete with Krishna. Sometimes, of course, having acquired a fragmental portion of Krishna's mystic power, asuras demonstrate their powers to the foolish public and assert themselves to be God, not knowing that God is the supreme Yogeshwara. And so, that's the thing, the materialist may be amazed by it because everyone wants opulence, everyone wants power and influence. So anyone who can show any of that, they're so impressed. Remember talking with, we were at a lunch program in Madras, and this other sadhu had been invited somehow or another. You know, they're Hindus, so, you know, sadhus. Okay, we're sadhus, and this guy's a sadhu. And then he was talking about how he had met or had spent some time with, who's the guy with the frizzy hair? Not Jean. Sai Baba, yes. Sati Sai Baba.
Sai Baba is different.
No, that's Shirdi Sai. You say Shirdi Sai Baba and Sati Sai Baba.
So you're speaking
of Sati Sai Baba. Yeah, so Satya. So, and that, and he said that while they're talking, then he just manifests these, you know, brand new, like, you know, out of the bank, 1,000 rupee notes. They used to have them at that time. So, until Ms. Gandhi, you know, did what the present guy did with the 1,000 rupee notes, right? And so then, you know, like that, he was so impressed. Like, you know, just he was really with, you know, with real appreciation and enthusiasm talking about it like that. You know, so that's the thing. People are really impressed. They really, so in this way is that they have these powers and they're impressed, but the devotees are never impressed because Krishna is the origin of all that. He is wealth. That piece of paper has value because of Krishna's mystic power. Why would anyone take a piece of paper and trade it for something of actual value? Right? I have a sack of potatoes. right? And I trade that for pieces of paper. Who would do that? Right? You know, but it's Krishna's potency of wealth. Therefore, then it's going on. Here we also see that Trinavarta assumed the Mahima Siddhi and took Krishna away as if Krishna were an ordinary child. But Krishna also became a mystic Mahima Siddha. When Mother Yashoda was carrying him, he became so heavy that his mother, who was usually accustomed to carrying him, could not bear him and had to place him down on the ground. So becoming lighter than lightest, heavier than heaviest, like that, the Krishna's, you know, can outdo them. Thus, Trinavarta had been able to take Krishna away in the presence of Mother Yashoda. But when Krishna, high in the sky, assumed the Mahima Siddhi, the demon, unable to go further, was obliged to stop his force and come down according to Krishna's desire. Because, remember, it's not about just going up, it's going up and coming down. That's the thing, you know, because the mother will throw you up and you come down. So he wants to go up and come down, right? You know, so that's the goal. So just, he was so heavy, he's spinning, but he stopped, you know, so the whirlwind, everything stops, you know. And then it's kind of like, uh-oh, yeah. One should not, therefore, compete with Krishna's mystic power. That's why then we assist, we serve. All these potencies are Krishna's, so we simply serve. We don't try to control them, we don't try to enjoy them. We simply work within the framework of how they function. And in a way, it's recommended to use them for Krishna. Because we're thinking, no, I have this knowledge. No, we have the knowledge to take part in as an assistant to the actual thing. But it's going on without us. Otherwise, how is it able to be observed? Because if we can observe it, and we don't know, it means it's already there. Then we start to see patterns, so then we come up with some scientific, you know, concept. Then we say, you know, now I control this, but you don't. You can only take part in it. Yes?
Bungee jumping has its origin in Krishna. Bungee jumping has its origin in Krishna.
But in the reverse, you go down, then you come back up.
The reflection.
Oh, yeah. The perverted reflection. Yeah, you go up, then you come down. The bungee guy goes down, and then comes back up. Yeah, because you probably don't find it, you don't think it's great until they pull you all the way back up and you're standing on your feet again. Otherwise, you know, it's like that. What is it? You're on Hoover Dam, it's like 900 feet or something, and you're being pulled up upside down for 900 feet. That's probably not great. But once you're back on your feet, then, okay. Yeah, so the reflection. Devotees automatically have all mystic power, but they do not like to compete with Krishna. Instead, they fully surrender to Krishna, and their yogic power is demonstrated by Krishna's mercy. Devotees can show mystic power so powerful that a demon could not even dream of it, but they never try to demonstrate it for their personal sense gratification. Whatever they do is for the service of the Lord, and therefore they are always in a position superior to that of the demons. Right? So that you basically see, you never see them manifested, unless it's something that is in Krishna's service, like Arjuna and his fighting with the whole battlefield. Or, you know, Indra and all the host of demigods, and they're the biggest controllers in the universe, can't fight with the Nivadikavachas. Right? And Arjuna alone kills them all. Like that. And then on the way back, there's another group of demons that, you know, as a bonus, then he kills all of them. You know? So like that, then the mystic power is seen. But it's only because it's serving Krishna. But for themselves, like Prahlad Maharaj is being attacked by all this. But, you know, Krishna's arrangement. So he just prays to Krishna and surrenders to Krishna, and then Krishna takes care. Like that. You know? So in that way, the greatest mystic ability is that to be able to, through pure love, control Yogeshwara. He controls everybody, but then he's controlled by the love of his devotees. That's the greatest, you could say, mystic power. These other things are not very important. Sukadeva Goswami continued. Because of Krishna's weight, Trinavarta considered him to be like a great mountain or a hunk of iron. But because Krishna had caught the demon's neck, the demon was unable to throw him off, right? Otherwise, he'd just push him away. He therefore thought of the child as wonderful, since you could neither bear the child nor cast aside the burden. Right, so that's something he's never seen before. It's either he's more strong, or he can get rid of, you know, something. But, you know, this is, whoa. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur elaborates. Having fulfilled his desire to fly in sky, and having fulfilled the desire of the women of Swarga by giving them a glance of his beauty, so they went up quite high then. You know? So if they're hanging out in the clouds, then, you know, they could see him, so at least that high. Krishna then got ready to kill Trinavarta. So that's the point. He does many things at once. Right? So he wants to go up in the sky and come down, and they want to see him. You know, he's down there in Braj, they can't see. So he comes up so they can see him. Krishna then got ready to kill Trinavarta. Krishna became heavier than Trinavarta and fell like iron. Right? So he's heavier than the heaviest. I mean, he's heavy. So therefore he can pick up anything. Right? You can't pick up something if you're not heavier than that, right? Because otherwise, according to, you know, the laws of physics, you'll fall over. Right? You pick up something, it falls over. Like you have something, let's say you have a you know something, and you put something too heavy on one side, it falls over. So you have to be heavier. So then, from this, what was it, Mahima, Siddhi, he was heavier, and there he could pick up. But then Krishna became heavier than him. Krishna became heavier than Trinavarta and felt like iron, as heavy as a mountain. Right, so a chunk, a hunk of iron as heavy as a mountain. So, but Trinavarta could not throw him off because Krishna was holding him by the neck. Playing the part of a small child, Krishna seemed afraid of falling from that height and therefore clung to Trinavarta's neck. Right? You know, because well, you know, they just hold on, but he couldn't get rid of him. Right? He's to this and that. He can't get rid of him. Whenever he's in the painting, you know, he's there hanging off and he's trying to pull him. It doesn't work. Like that. Yes. So he's having fun.
Om Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Hare Hare
Srila Prabhupada ki Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki Jai Nitai Gaura Premananda.